Blog Talk Radio.
It's time.
Some paper towels and you start putting it around it so it doesn't keep spreading.
That's what containment is. They're trying to contain the fire from spreading. And they've been unable to do that because of the high winds out here. And the high winds have been about 35 miles per hour daily, and also gusts up to 45 miles per hour, which has resulted in them not being able to use air support to drop water and fire retardant on the fire to keep it contained. But the Crystal New Mexico community was at risk, but then the winds came in, high winds came in, and drove the fire east and over the Chuska Mountains. And on the other side of the Chuska Mountains are the communities of Sheep Springs, New Mexico, and Nachiti, New Mexico. And the last fire reports were that there were some evacuations of families. About 50 families were evacuated because of the fire. So evacuation centers have been set up in Tohatchee, New Mexico, at the schools there, also in Newcomb at the schools. Shiprock chapter, which is in New Mexico, has also opened up its chapter for a evacuation center, as well as Sheep Springs chapter. And the Sheep Springs chapter officials have said that they are open 24/7 for individuals that need any type of assistance. And it's been interesting about other unofficial reports that are coming in. And I want to turn that over to my co-host here, Sharon Mays, who is a former news colleague and also was on radio. So she's been getting some information coming in about what individuals are seeing in the area.
Hi, Marley. Hi to our listeners. First of all, I'd like to begin our start, you know, with our program. We are really having some interesting power fluctuations, and we're so sorry about the rough start, but we're hoping that we're able to, you know, you're able to hear us. I noticed that we're kind of going in and out, and the lights are dimming and kind of, you know, getting bright again, and they're dimming. And you were talking about that was the fire is affecting some power lines.
Well, Navajo Tribal Utility Authority, which
is the utility enterprise here on the Navajo Reservation, had reported that some of their power lines they had to actually take off the grid because there was problems dealing with the fire going very near those power lines, and if they if the fire got to those power lines, then it would pretty much there would be an explosion. And then one of the firefighters was also explaining that
firefighters go underneath power lines, there is
also the possibility of power lines acting as lightning bolts, which would put the firefighters in great danger. And I was out at Monday, it must have been about 7 o'clock or around there that all of a sudden the lights went out. And they were wondering what was happening. So they called in, and that's when they found out that the power lines had been shut down because the fire had gotten very close to them.
Well, before we started the show, we were kind of musing at the fact that, you know, the lights are dimming and they're getting bright, and it's kind of giving us a little ambiance here. But unfortunately, it is due to the fire.
That fire is hopefully
they said that it would be 5% contained this evening because the weather predictions for the high winds was going to be greatly reduced, and they were hoping to get the air support out there all day, and they said that they were being very successful in getting the fire contained on the south side of the fire, which is around Crystal, New Mexico. And this fire is close to the Arizona-New Mexico border. The Navajo Reservation covers a majority of the northern part of Arizona, a good part of New Mexico, and then, you know, a little strip of Utah. So this fire is, if you were going from Gallup, New Mexico, up to Shiprock, New Mexico, you would see it along the way there. All the smoke is coming out, and so, you know, that's what's happening right now. And I'd like to, you know, have our co-host, you know, tell us about some of the interesting stories that she's been receiving about the fire.
We got some reports from the front line that that people were seeing some extraordinary things. And an example of that is one of the reports from the front line is a person saw two mountain lions, a skunk and a badger, leaving together, trying to get away from the fire. And then yesterday, one person, her brother, texted her from the front lines of the fire, and they saw three coyotes, two mountain lions, a bear, a fox, and three wolves, all these predators together leaving, trying to get away from the fire. I mean, that's extraordinary, and how very Navajo, huh, that all these animals are working together just to get away from the fire as quickly as possible.
Where they saw these animals leaving together?
The two mountain lions, the skunk and the badger, was seen in the crystal area. And then the others, they were seen higher up, closer to Narbona Pass.
Well, the road between that goes from
Mexico into Crystal, New Mexico, which goes to Narbona Pass, that's been closed, just for, you know, our listeners to be informed about that. And for any of our listeners that might have some stories about the fire, we'd ask you to call 347-989-0048. And the number again is 347-989-0048. And I'd like my co-host again, Sharon Mays, to talk about the fire a little bit here, because you had heard some reports about President Shelley being out there doing a flyover.
And also just the story that I heard was that he was at Nosechitty and talking to the people, and the report that we got from there is that he just made the remark that that he has seen bigger fires. Now, in my lifetime, I have never seen a fire on Narbona Pass like this ever. Never, never. And the other thing, too, is that it's just we're also getting reports that there have been hot shots coming from all the different tribes, like the Apache and the Hopi and the Zuni. And I just think that is just extraordinary. That's amazing, you know, that they're coming to help here. Have you heard about that, Marley?
Oh, yes. I spoke with
Fire Operations Director. His name is Dave Gesser. And he told me today that there are 13 hotshot crews out there, and that they had actually ordered a very large air tanker to come in and to assist, and that they had two other crews that were coming in, the Type 2 wildland firefighter crews. And for the individuals that are unfamiliar with wildland firefighting, the hotshot crews are considered Type 1 firefighters, and they are very elite firefighting crews. The Type 2 wildland firefighters are just as good, but the qualifications to be a hotshot are much higher physically. I was talking with Navajo Times illustrator Jack Hostein, and he wanted to know what the difference was, and I told him, well, for one thing, they drop the hotshots right along the fire line. And those individuals have to carry backpacks that are between 80 and 100 pounds. And when they drop them, they have to be, they're out there on the fire line. They don't come back in and take showers, get hot meals, and get a chance to sleep. They're right out there on the fire line. The Type 2 firefighters, they go in along the fire line, and then they'll leave and come back to camp. But the fire is taken care of 24/7. So you have crews out there. They also use what they call dozers, and these are bulldozers. And so they have, according to Dave Gesser, who's with the Southwest Incident Management Team, he said that they had ordered also three more dozers, so they have a total of six of these bulldozers out there building the fire. Why he was hoping that by the 7 p.m. that they would be able to report that there was at least a 5% containment of this fire. But it's like a...
All right, you know, it's for all of us civilians, you know, we really do appreciate all these hotshot crews, all the firemen that are out there fighting this fire. But something that I think a lot of our listeners may not know is someone who really appreciates it is you, Marley, because you actually trained as a firefighter.
That's true, Sharon. When I, several years ago, I wanted to do a story on the Navajo Scouts, which are the Type 2 wildland firefighters. They're well known within the firefighting community, and oftentimes they are actually compared to hotshots, and they qualified to have a hotshot crew, and you have to go through several strenuous physical tests, and also they do the how much knowledge you have of fire behavior to have your own hotshot crew, and they were able to do that. So the Navajo Nation has its own hotshot crew, and the firefighting training, I was told after I had gone through it that when I actually went out with the Navajo Scouts was in talking with other wildland firefighters is that a lot of them were only trained for maybe
half of what the Navajo
Scouts are trained. Navajo Scouts go through a week of training, and it's physical, and they also have a lot of fire behavior testing. You also have to learn about the weather and how that affects the fire. You also have to understand, you know, what you have to do as a crew, that you're out there as a crew. It's compared to paramilitary. You have to be at your physical and also mental best because you are part of a crew. And when you go out there, the person in front of you, beside you, you have to be responsible for them. They're responsible for you. So you have to be in tip-top shape, and that's what our Navajo Scouts are. That's what these firefighters go through. And when I went through it, they also have to have a physical test. You have to do the running. You have to do the chin-ups. You have to do the sit-ups. And I can't remember because it was several years ago, but I do remember the pack test. You carry a 45-pound pack on your back for 3.5 miles, and you have to do it in 45 minutes. And so when I kept asking and asking to go out and be with the Navajo Scouts to do a story, and they said, you know, they kept telling me no, but I kept going back over. They said no, and I keep going back over. And finally, the fire coordinator, the training director, he told me, he says, okay, he says, but if you're going to do it, you're going to the whole week. And I said, okay, you know, I can do that. And then he said, and you're going to do the physical test. And I said, okay, you know, I'll do the running. I could do the running and do the 3 miles in 12 minutes. And he says, nope. And I said, well, you know, I'm not going to do the chin-ups. And he says, nope. And I said, you're not going to make me do the pack test. And he goes, yeah. But I realized after going through that whole week of training and doing the pack test that it was done because I had to understand completely what was going on. Because, like I said, we're working as a crew out there, and I had to be knowledgeable about what was going on. Otherwise, I would have been a liability to my crew. And
exactly.
And that was not what I wanted to do as a news reporter. I wanted to be out there.
They did, and I was able to do that. I was able to experience that, and it was amazing.
Salute. I was amazed you were able to do that. The pack test, that was the one that just I marveled at the fact that you were able to do that. That is not at all easy. One thought I had with all the crews that are here, all the hotshot crews, is, oh, my goodness, you know, these are usually, you know, the first teams that go out to all the other forest fires that are in the nation. And, you know, I'm just hoping that, you know, there isn't another major fire anywhere, you know, because these are the gents that you and the ladies that also, you know, they're the ones who respond to that as well, you know, like in California, Idaho, in Colorado. They go all over the nation.
Well, that's what you have the Southwest Incident Management Team Commander, and so she is heading this the whole operation, and she has several individuals that she works with and coordinates with, and it is huge.
Marley, say her name again. You kind of faded out with the power fluctuations.
Her name is Dave, and she's a doctor, and she takes care of everything. She has to take care of crews that are out there, and this is not just the wildland firefighters, type 1 and type 2, which is the hot shots and the wildland firefighters. But she also takes care of operations, which deals in that operation. She has someone who oversees that. But that individual also handles the air transport and the dozers. And then you have individuals that are feeding the wildland firefighters, because you have out there close to 700 personnel, wildland firefighters that are out there. It's huge. And it's huge because this fire has gotten so large, and it got so large because of the high winds. And that was a major factor. At each of these briefings, they have talked about the impact of the high winds on the fire, that they couldn't do the direct attack because it was so unpredictable. The winds would come in, and they just wouldn't know which way the fire was going to go. And so they had, you know, that was putting the firefighters at risk. So they were trying to build the fire lines around it, around the fire, to try to contain it, but the winds would just blow that fire right over the lines of fire lines.
One of my most memorable interviews that I did was with an Apache hotshot crew member, and she was an amazing woman. And one of the things that she brought out in the interview that I did with her was that as a firefighter, and maybe you can speak a little bit to this, is they train you to listen to the fire, and different fires, you know, sound differently, and you can tell, like, the most dangerous, because I asked her, you know, which fire scares you the most, and she said that the rolling fire, what we call the rolling fire, and I go, what does that mean? And she said, literally, what happens is it will roll over the tops of trees, the force and the winds behind it, and as it's rolling down a hill, you know, at unbelievable speeds, that it sets everything on fire as it goes. And you can just imagine the different kinds of, you know, with the winds you're talking about, the high winds they're having to deal with, my goodness, all the different kinds of, you know, fires that they're having to deal with up there.
Well, that's why I during each of the updates on the fire, that they have repeatedly emphasized that the high winds have been a major factor. Because if you, anyone, individual that is out there and has any, you know, that builds any kind of fire, or you have a fire on the outside and you're cooking, if you really look at that fire very closely, you'll see every once in a while a little whirlwind in there. And then you can, you know, if it's starting to go out, you add more fuel to it, which is wood. And if it starts, you know, smoking and you need to keep it going, you give it some air. So those are factors in keeping that fire going. And right now a key factor, like I said, is that air. And when it drives it, what that firefighter was talking about is it's fire that is topping, and it goes across the trees. And it's going across the trees, and you kind of have to think of how you have a brush fire. But these are trees. And then you have to remember that up in that area and over most of the reservation and the southwest, there's a major drought. We are in a major drought. And people need to understand that. And when I was talking with commander, B. Day, and also some of her her supervisors, which, you know, are the operations, and they also have safety, they were talking about warning or, you know, just telling people to be careful about even driving over grass, tall grass that we have out here, because it's so dry, and your vehicle can actually ignite it. And also, if you are out and you're getting wood, that you have to be careful, because it can spark and create a fire, and that wind will just pick it up. And a lot of people have been asking at each of the meetings that I've been at how this fire started, who started it. And it started in Camp Masai, which is a recreational area. There's fishing, there's a lake out there. And maybe someone was out there and they had just, you know, decided to have a cookout, or who knows what was happening out there. But it started, and the Navajo scouts tried to contain it, but the high winds came in, and it just took off. And I don't think that I was at a meeting of the Resources and Development Committee, which is a standing committee of the Navajo Nation Council. And this was yesterday, and they wanted a report from the chief of staff, who is Arvin Mitchell, and he's been attending a lot of these fire updates. And they wanted to know, you know, how come this fire got so out of hand, you know, and one of them was trying to make a recommendation about, well, we need to have, you know, these types of equipment out here, and I think that's one thing that the elected officials need to understand is that when you're talking about a wildland fire, you're talking about high winds, that the Navajo Scouts did the best they could. They have the helicopters that go in that are the first responders. As soon as they see the smoke in these areas, a helicopter goes out. They have crews there. They go in. And then the Navajo Scouts also have their own dozers, which go in, and they also have their water tankers. They have their own crews, and they go in. But we're talking about a very dry area. If you go into that area, it's very, very dry. And so it was at 40 acres, and then those high winds came in and just immediately drove it up to 200, and then it was out of control. And that's when they made a good decision on Sunday and said, we need to call in outside resources. And that's when the Southwest Incident Management Team came in. And for our listeners, you have across the reservation all these different divisions of federally funded agencies for wildland firefighting, and it's across the country. And so you have the ones that are from Northwest and all these different other areas, and they are able to call in wildland firefighters from different states. And so when I was talking with some of the team members, they were saying that they had wildland firefighters from Arizona, from Utah, and from New Mexico, and that it was difficult for them to explain, but I guess it was just, you know, they were saying that, you know, that since there weren't any other major fires in the country, that was a benefit for the Navajo Reservation, that they were able to call in all these resources that weren't out there at other major fires to help out here. And there was a campaign. There's a campaign right now that's going on that's being led by Eric Deschini and Myron McLaughlin, and their children from Chin Lee, from the Chin Lee area, are writing thank you notes. And they're going to deliver them to the wildland firefighters.
That's wonderful. And just, you know, just as a person, you know, that can't go up there and fight it, you know. I'm so grateful to all these hotshot crews, and we continue, you know, to wish and to pray for their safety, because this, as you said, this whole area is such a tinderbox, and those winds are, you know, they're just unmerciful the way that they're pushing and fueling this fire. So those two gentlemen that you mentioned, are they not running for Navajo president?
Yes, they are. The press release that was not on the press release, but they are the ones that are leading that campaign. And you have, at this time I want to talk about donations also. While I was at the meeting this morning, the liaison from the Navajo Nation that's working between the Navajo Nation government and the Southwest Incident Management Team, her name is Rose Whitehair, and she was explaining to individuals about donations. And she said that monetary donations should go to the Red Cross, and that any other donations also should go through her. So I want to, after we're going to take a little break.
The number for our listeners, and you can call that number. And also
we posted that on the Facebook.
Well,
thank you.
Blog Talk Radio. You're listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation, sponsored by CalMez Design. And here, once again, is your host, Marley Shabala.
Dr. Inc., this is Marley Shabala, Politics on the Navajo Nation. And I'd like to encourage people to call in if they have any comments or would like to share.
Concerning the fire out here, which is the Asai Lake Fire, and the phone number that you can call in is 347-989-0048. Or if you would just like to make any kind of comment that's not even related to the fire, we'd love to hear from you. But I have the press release from the Southwest Incident Management Team 3. And for additional information, you can visit their website. They actually have a Facebook website. So it's facebook.com/ Asai Lake Fire. And that's spelled capital A-S-S-A-Y-I, capital L-A-K-E, capital F-I-R-E. And you can also go to the National Firefighting website, and that, and these are all lowercase letters, nwcg.inciweb.gov. And there's also a fire information line, and that line is 928-362-1482. And we have a caller, so we're going to be going to that caller. Hello? Hello, can you hear me?
Hello, are you there? You're on Blog Talk Radio?
This is Bill Donovan.
Hey,
hey Bill.
Howdy.
And for our listeners, this is Bill Donovan, and he also is a guest, a regular guest on Politics on the Navajo Nation. And Bill is a editor for the Gallup New Mexico paper, and also a correspondent for the Navajo Times paper, which is located in Durant, Arizona. So Bill, tell us what's happening.
Well, I'm going to talk about something that people are not talking about, and that is the Navajo Tribal Council races. So far this election season, all the attention seems to be on the 16 men and one woman who have filed for tribal president. But anyone who knows anything about how the tribal government works realizes that the power rests with the members of the Navajo Nation Council and not the tribal president. A situation that has existed since the Reform Acts in 1990. Although members of the council fought hard to keep the council from being reduced from 88 to 24 members 4 years ago, most delegates now think the move was a good one. The new alignment means that most delegates will be representing five or more chapters, and in many cases this means that the candidates who are from the biggest chapters have a distinct advantage in the election. Eight members of the current council did not file papers. They are Russell Begay, Catherine Benally, Joshua Butler, Charles Damon, Kenneth Maryboy, Johnny Nez, Roscoe Smith, and Dwayne Tessagini. The interesting part about this is that two of them, Russell Begay and Catherine Maryboy, are running for tribal president. And the interesting part about this is it's from a financial standpoint. The president of the tribe only makes about $55,000 a year. He has no money for fees or anything else. He stays at $55,000. Now, a tribal council delegate makes makes a base of $25,000. And then he gets fees for going to meetings and doing various jobs within the tribal council. So they actually make somewhere around $70,000 to $80,000. So both Russell Begay and Catherine Maryboy decided to take a shot at tribal president, which pays less, and in some cases doesn't have as much power as a tribal council delegate. Both of them said that they realized this, but they felt that they could do more good as tribal president. So it's going to be interesting to see how well their decision is for their future. Arlie?
You know, Bill, when you talk about the, you know, the salary.
Are you including their mileage, their stipends?
I put everything together. We were told about 2 years ago that because of the less number of council delegates, they are doing more work and going to more meetings. And that means that they are getting more money. And we were told that the average council delegate will probably make about $80,000
a year. And what is the average income on the Navajo Reservation? I know the
It's probably a lot lower than that. It's probably around the $15,000 or $16,000 level.
Yeah, so, you know, we're talking about the elected officials making a lot more than the average Navajo person. And we also wonder again, and maybe you might have information on this, are they still filing campaign financial statements so that people know who's donating to them?
Yes, they have to do that after the primary, yeah, 10 days after the primary. The big question is how accurate is that statement? The election office says they don't do any investigating on it, so they just rely on what the candidate says he's turning in. And we heard in the past that the bigger people who want to donate and don't want their names in there, they don't put them in. So I think they're not exactly accurate.
So are these accessible to their constituents or anybody? Can they just go over there and find out who's donating or who has donated?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can go to the election office, and you have to pay 35 cents a page or 50 cents a page, but you can get it. And there's been some talk about putting it online. Now, if you're a candidate in New Mexico and you run, you have to file a candidate statement every 4 weeks or 6 weeks, and that's online. So you can go to the Secretary of State's office, and they have them all on that site.
That would be good if all that information was available online. We need to get more information available online. You know, have you heard of any of the campaign forums or for council delegates like they are having for the presidential?
What do you mean by that?
Well, are they having any forums like at the community level?
Oh, there's going to be another forum on Monday at Gray Hills Academy in Tuba City from 6 to 9, and it'll be on the radio. They don't think it's going to be streamed because they still got problems with that, but there will be another one there, and all 17 candidates have been invited to attend.
Delegates are running and they're being unopposed. I know that Jonathan Nez from Shonto, there's no one opposing him, but some of them, I think it's Shiprock. How many are running from Shiprock for council seat?
About seven. But there's Alton Joe Shepherd from Ganado and Jonathan Nez of Shonto don't have any opposition in the primary. And that means that if they don't get any write-in candidates, after the primary, they have already won the election. So they have it pretty easy for this coming election season.
Bill, it's Sharon Mays. All those that are running for council delegate, do you see any familiar names?
Oh, yeah. Do you remember David John?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. He's running. Genevieve Jackson is running. So there are names on there that are very, that we know from past elections. Raymond Max is running. He used to be a council delegate, and he used to be heavily into. He's with the land dispute office now.
And also, Marley, you told me about who's running from Torreon, another familiar face.
Do you remember Daniel Snow, Bill?
Oh, yeah, Daniel, the 41 of the 49ers.
Yeah, he is running, and that seat is currently held by Council Delegate Leonard Sosi.
And that'd be interesting because, because Raymond Snow had a lot of popularity at one time.
What did you say again?
Raymond Snow had a lot of popularity at one time, back in the early 1990s.
Oh, she said Leonard Sosi. That's his position.
Leonard Sosi also has a lot of popularity, although he's not very popular in the council.
Why do you say that, Bill?
Well, when I talk to council guys, they kind of look at, they don't know where Leonard Sosi is coming from sometimes. And he's not considered one of the good old boys. He's too independent.
Too independent, huh?
Too independent, yes.
Well, you know that the Hopi chairman came before the Navajo committee and was giving a report about the proposed Escalade project, which is, you know, that huge project that's being proposed to build on the confluence out on part of the Grand Canyon. And when Council Delegate Dwight Witherspoon wanted the Hopi Chairman's statement to become a part of the record, part of the report, Council Delegate that they should, then that would be taking a position that could possibly result in a lawsuit against the council, and so the council would be supporting a lawsuit. It was an interesting kind of an argument.
Yeah, and the council then associates is really interesting sometimes because it goes against the other council delegates. I remember also back a couple council positions ago, council sessions ago, a young Jeff Tom was on the council, and we always enjoyed covering him because there's no telling what he would do because he came up with a lot of wild ideas.
Marley, is it true that they only gave the Hopi chairman 2 minutes to speak?
The report to the committee had been requested by families from the Bottoway Gap area who were opposing this development, the Escalade project. And so it was Hopi chairman and vice chairman and several of the councilmen and staff members showed up and they asked part of the report. And their request was made to Speaker Pro Tem Lorenzo Bates, who said that he was going to possibly have the agenda amended to allow for the Hopi delegation to speak. And the Hopi chairman, Honani, had asked to have their Hopi cultural special because the Hopi tribe had taken official position opposing the Escalade project of the same reasons that the families were giving, with that the area was sacred, and they were also talking about other tribes. It didn't end up coming before the committee when they were adopting their agenda, and Speaker Pro Tem asked Hopi Chairman Honani to come up and introduce his delegation. It did on the floor that he was going to have having problems trying to say the Hopi names. And so the Hopi chairman introduced the vice chairman and everyone that was there with him. And then they went into the report on the confluence from the families. They heard from the families. And by the end, the speaker said, well, this says to give your presentation. So the Hopi chairman, he was very, I spoke to him before the meeting, and he was very understanding about it. He said that he didn't, you know, he respected the protocol of the Navajo Nation government. And then they had this huge debate in front of him regarding whether or not he accepted his report. And then there was the Council Delegate Dwayne Timogeny said that he had found out from one of his sources or from one of the Navajo Department of Justice attorneys that the Hopi tribe was planning to file a lawsuit against him. So that was brought. There were just all these other issues that came into play. And I think that, Bill, you understand that there's a lot of history between the Hopi tribal government and the Navajo Nation government.
Oh, yes. It goes back a long way, too.
Do you recall a Hopi chairman and the vice chairman and their council members actually coming to the Navajo Council to a standing committee?
I don't remember them ever doing it. I remember them coming to the old advisory committee meetings a couple times to talk about issues, trying to get some peace between the two tribes and the joint use area, urging that the Navajos in that area not get involved in any kind of violence in that area. That's the only thing I remember.
Ivan City.
Yeah, they were supposed to be friends. I remember that, yes.
Do you remember them
ever sitting under a tree, Bill?
No. Did they?
Well, that's what I'm asking you. You know, if anybody would know about these two leaders sitting under a tree, I figure it would be you, because you always got...
Well, I don't remember. All I remember is that during those days, Cindy and Saab were supposed to be very good friends. And they talked very good about each other. And whenever we interviewed one about the other, they'd always say good things about it.
I think that it's wonderful that the current Hopi chairman was so understanding, you know, about, you know, council procedure. Because there was a big buzz here in Window Rock about him only getting those 2 minutes. So thank you, Marley, for explaining that, because people were afraid that perhaps he had been slighted, or, they comments like, you know, oh my gosh, what if, you know, our president went to, you know, the Hopis and they were only given 2 minutes. Would they be so understanding about it? So I'm glad you did have a chance to explain that.
Maury, I have a hard time hearing you. Karen, what was the question?
She just wanted to know if you, in your opinion, do you believe had Shelley only been given 2 minutes, would he have been as understanding as the Hope chairman was?
No, and the staff would not have been either. They'd have been really upset about it, and they would have been very vocal about it.
Well, I think because this issue of the Escalade and Save the Confluence is such a major issue this election, I think that's why so many people here in Window Rock, you know, they really wanted to hear what the Hopi chairman had to say, and they wanted to make sure that, you know, they were not, sliding him in any way and giving him the due respect that, you know, Native people should give each other's leaders.
Marley.
Bill, can you hear me?
I hear you. You're going in and out, but I hear you.
Oh, okay. Do you have any parting comments regarding the...
I wanted to bring up one more thing. What I'm going to be working on this week for the Navajo Times is the fact that there are 14 women running for tribal council. And I think this is the most women ever who have run for tribal council. And I'm checking to see how good a chance they have of doing it. Because, we, as you know, we only have one woman council together now, and she's not running again. So there's a good chance there might be more women in the council next time than there have maybe ever have been in the history of the tribal council.
I agree with you. That really is amazing, 14. That is the most.
Yes. And what I'm seeing, though, also is that a couple of races I'm looking at is that they're taking the position that the men have messed it up. Now let's go and get the women in there so they can bring everything back together again.
Well, I know you support that, Bill. Thank you for supporting all the candidates.
Of course, I support all the candidates. Yeah.
And I know our listeners want to come up on all of the women candidates and your personal interviews. So thanks again, Bill.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Okay. Talk to you later.
Oh, we have another caller. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air. Oh, no? Okay. Well, they disappeared. Let's try again one more time, okay? Caller, are you there? Caller, are you there? Hello? Blog Talk Radio, are you there? Okay. Okay, Marley, that was very interesting. I mean, my goodness, 14 women, that's, you know, exciting news.
Yeah, that is. You know, I'm wondering how that is going to play out because I was looking at the list of the candidates, and you have almost at each of the precincts, you have an individual that's running. I see for White Rock, Lake Valley, Nahodishkish, and Vicente, Naizi, Crown Point, Herfano, that Rosalyn Smith is running, and also Janice Padilla. And there's actually eight candidates from that for that one council delegate position. Jonathan Perry is running, and he's running from Vicente chapter, and he has been very outspoken regarding the uranium issues and water, and he is a Vicente chapter vice president. Gilbert Roger, he's from the White Rock chapter, and you also have Julius Elwood, and he's a staff assistant to Elton Shepherd, who's a council delegate. And for our listeners, this is the first time that the council delegates have had personal assistants or staff assistants, and they're 24, and they say that it's because they are also representing more chapters, and they are. There's 110 chapters, and it was divided among the 24, whereas before you had 88 delegates that were representing the 110 chapters. And also you have Andrew C. Charlie from Naizi, who's running, Ben Woody Jr. from Herfano chapter, and then Danny Simpson. And he is the, actually I think it might be Danny, yeah, Danny Simpson is the current council delegate. He's the incumbent, so he's running again.
It's amazing that, you know, it's just like you pointed out, you know, before this particular council, this is the first council we've had of 24. And, you know, that was one of the concerns that, you know, they would be representing so many other chapters. But, you know, compared to the 88 council delegates we had before. But it seems like it's working, wouldn't you say?
The 24?
Yeah, the 24 representing that, you know, more than just one chapter, more than just one area. Because before, remember, the 88, and that was one of the concerns that we kept hearing time and time again that, you know, if we only have 24, you know, council delegates, some chapters are not going to be adequately represented.
Well, there's issues over how they're being represented, and it's from what I have seen at, and I cover the council, I cover their committee meetings, and they have difficulty getting a quorum. And that was one of the big issues of the 88, is that they had problems getting a quorum, and they also had problems keeping a quorum, and that's occurring still. And you also have the issue over accountability, because there is just actually, if the constituents from each of these areas know where their council delegates are when they don't show up at the committee meetings or at the council meetings. A good example is the Speaker Johnny Nace and his representation for his communities. He's been placed on administrative leave by the council on April 4th, and he has not attended any council meetings or the top committee meeting, which is the NABI meeting, NABI committee meetings, and he is still a council delegate.
So he was removed as speaker.
He was not removed as speaker. He was placed on administrative leave, so he still has his title as speaker. That's why Council Delegate Lorenzo Bates is Speaker Pro Tem. It's up to Speaker Nays to push through his the criminal charges and get those resolved. Because if he's found by the courts to
not guilty, he comes back as speaker. He's removed. But either way, he should be there as a council delegate. He still has that position. He's legally recognized as a council delegate. But if he is continuing council and the committee and sponsoring legislation, then his community needs to ask him what he's doing as a council delegate and representing them.
Okay, please, Marley. Okay, sometimes we have to play devil's advocate, and the reason why I put it that way is because I want you to explain it again, because I'm still hearing people here in the capital of the Navajo Nation who think that he was removed as speaker. Now, if you wouldn't mind, one more time, because it is. It's very confusing what all happened and what is his position now. So he was not removed.
They did attempt to remove him as speaker because he had lost the qualification, which was to be in good standing as a council delegate. When he was voted in as speaker in his first term, which was 4 years ago, the speaker serves two-year term, and he was in good standing. He didn't have criminal charges against him. But those criminal charges were filed against him in his second term, which he is serving now. And so that was the reason that the council decided that they were going to remove him, but after much discussion decided that they would place him on administrative leave, allow him to keep his title, his salary, his call.
I'm so glad you explained that. Thank you. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back here on Blog Talk Radio with Politics on the Navajo Nation. Blog Talk Radio, you're listening to Marley Shabala on Politics on the Navajo Nation. Marley?
And we have a caller, And the caller, the number is 2130. That's the caller's number. Hello, caller, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're coming across real good.
Okay.
Yes, we can hear you. You're coming across loud and clear.
Okay, I'm just a guest. I'm just calling in. I'm a guest. Actually, I'm a blogger off Twitter, and I saw your tweet come across that your show was on, and I have a human rights blog. It's Joe's crime blog / human rights blog, and I saw your show was going to be on, so I decided to call in. I found it very interesting that I saw that a while back. I did a story on my blog about how you guys put your language on. Native Innovations created a program and put your language on iPhones and stuff for texting for your youngsters for the language and stuff. And I thought that was pretty neat the way you guys they designed that program for the iPhones. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
Yes, we are.
Yeah, I thought it was a really neat thing because I'm on my human rights blog. I have over 50 countries that go to my blog and visit me, and so most of the time I have to use Google Translate. So I know how to speak Arabic, or I use Google Translate so I can speak Arabic or Russian or whatever, so I could translate. So a lot of times they kind of like go, wow, how's this guy know what we're talking about, because I just go to Google Translate, and translate Arabic or whatever. But before I knew it, I've been blogging for over a little over a year, maybe almost 2 years, and I have over 50 countries visiting my site. So, but I saw your tweet, so I just wanted to stop by and say hello. And I think I have over 300 or 400 Navajo members that follow me on my Twitter account. I have 7,000 people following me. And I think I have around 800 Native American members, but I think I have 300 or 400 Navajo members following me alone on my site. And my name is Joe Liska, and it's my blog is War Pony. It's called War Pony Blogspot. So anyhow, I just wanted to stop by and say hello. So I don't know if some of you seen my blog.
Okay, thank you. That's a very nice welcome, to social media, all of us that are doing this. Marley wanted to know, are you indigenous, and where are you located?
Oh, yes, I am. It's actually, it's kind of a long story, but I'll make it short. I'm actually from California, but I live in Arizona. I live in Tucson. And I grew up in both places, in San Diego and in Arizona. But my father... My tribes, I'm from two different tribes in California, but my grandmother's full-blooded Cahuilla Indian from Inanza, California, and my grandfather's half Pechanga Indian in Temecula, California. So that's I'm a Mission Indian from that area, in that area over there. So, yes, I am. That answers the question there. So I have family out there, but I live in Arizona, and I've probably lived in Arizona for 10 or 15 years off and on. So I kind of consider this, my mom and dad moved out here and retired out here, so I kind of really kind of consider this kind of like my home out here, really, because I'm out here a lot. My daughter's going to U of A out here, too, so I kind of like came out here in Tucson, and she's going to U of A right now. So I'm kind of retired, and I live out here in Tucson right now. So
you said your name was Joe?
Yeah, Joe.
Okay. Since you said you were Mission Indian, I might be interested in knowing how the language is surviving for your tribe, for your nation.
You know what? My sisters are elders, and my sisters were teaching it. I talked to my sisters. They're a lot older than me. What happened with me? I was given up for adoption as a child, as a baby. And then I came back and I found my sisters like 15 years ago. So I was like a coming home child. I came home and found my sisters 15 years ago, and they have a lot of they have huge casinos out there and a lot of political stuff going on about membership and stuff. So it was all heated, about who's who over there. But anyhow, my sisters are a lot older than me because my father was 45 and my mom was 21. So I came in there and and my sisters are like, I have like, I have sisters that are like 30 years older than me. So but my sisters were teaching. Elder sisters were teaching the language, but I don't get up there that much, you know. I'm pretty much here in Arizona a lot, and there's a lot of political things going on over there, and a lot of infighting and stuff over membership up there, and I just kind of stayed away from it, you know. I've been kind of like that's why I kind of like stay in Arizona, and I have a lot of friends, my Native American friends on Twitter, and it kind of keeps me grounded. Where I kind of like just I listen to you guys, I listen to you and my other tribes, and I kind of like just watch you guys and watch you guys talk, and it keeps me grounded into because to me, I mean, I have this the casinos and stuff. It's kind of a, I just see this nasty thing. It's like a really nasty thing I see happening because of all the casinos and all the big money, and especially in California, it's just like a nasty thing, you know. You know, Native Americans were rich in their heart before all that stuff came about, and it's so nasty over there, and fighting, this infighting over there in California. So I like to see people like your tribe and other tribes in Arizona, and Arizona is so rich in you know, Native American culture. So I get a kick out of just listening to you people, and you know, your tribe, the largest. You're the largest tribe in the United States, am I correct?
Yes. Yes, we are.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
yeah,
and you know, I really appreciate you calling and sharing your thoughts, because a lot of our people don't have that opportunity to travel and to see how our other relatives are doing and what's happening with their tribal government and how their members are being treated, especially dealing with the casino. That's still a sore spot here on the Navajo Reservation. But and the language itself, we still have quite a few. We have a lot of people. We still have a lot of people that are still speaking the language, and we have our ceremonies. We have a huge land base, and our people, I get to travel a lot, and our people just don't understand how blessed we are that we have such a large land base, that we are able to have our ceremonies, that we still have our language intact, our way of dressing and our hair, because in California, your land base is so small. It was reduced to...
Right, right. And I see your jingles dancers, and I see your powwows, and I see all this, and I'm just like going, wow, you know. I'm like I'm just like going, wow, and I'm just looking at all this, and then I talk to some of these your people, and they're saying some of them don't care for casinos, some of them don't want that, some of them are more traditional, you know what I mean? They don't want that. And then I even saw that when they had that guy that was walking the tightrope across the canyon, how some people didn't even want him walking across the canyon. Some people welcomed him to the canyon to walk across the canyon, and other people were saying, well, you know, we don't really want him here. And what if he falls, you know? I could see like traditional people saying, we don't want that. Some people wanted it. Some people didn't want it. You know what I mean? Because it's a beautiful place there. I just see your reservation has a lot of beautiful places there. You know what I'm saying? And just, you know what I mean? I just watch you guys because you are you're large, and I just watch your people, and it's very interesting to me. That's why I'm more interested in your tribe, because you're large, and I watch what you guys are doing, because it's very interesting because of what you have. And in your tradition, and I see that, you know, I mean, your traditions that you're upholding.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I mean? But just a little correction there, Joe. The jingle dress dancers, the powwow, those dances come from our relatives that are to the north, the Plains Indians. Our traditional way of dances is completely different. I mean, much different as you would see. Perhaps, you know, the Germans, do they still have their traditional dances? you know, the European nations. I'm not sure about their, you know, but they're very different. You know, the Germans and the French are very different, you know, from the even the English, and that's how different the tribes are. But I want to thank you for calling in, Joe, and for also tuning in and for sharing your comments and letting the listeners, especially our Navajo listeners, get a brief look at what life is outside the Navajo Reservation with our relatives there in California. And thank you, and the best for you and whatever you do,
okay.
Good health, strong body and mind.
You. Okay, thank you for letting me come by and talk tonight.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, that was Joe. And I'm going to once again ask our callers to call in at 347-989-0048. And that number again is 347-989-0048. And we have 46 minutes left of the program. And we were talking with Bill Donovan about the candidates for the Navajo Nation Council. And the Navajo Nation Council consists of 24 members. And so you have about 131 candidates for those 24 positions. And Bill Donovan pointed out that of those candidates, 131, there were 14 women that were running for those positions. And so I'm going to have Sharon Mays also talk about some of the issues regarding the Navajo Council, because she was a news reporter on the reservation for a number of years. Here you go.
Thank you, Marley. For this particular election, you know, we can't stress enough that the issues that are so important continue to be the Escalade. You know, that is still in its stage that, you know, they haven't broken ground on it, but they're still, you know, going full steam ahead with that. And the local residents are opposed to that development of a tram, you know, right there on Grand Canyon. Also, the uranium is a major, major issue. And one thing, Marley, I wish, could you please explain exactly what process this is, because I'm hearing so many different opinions about that here. You know, some people think it's actually, you know, they're going to go again like they did before, you know, all through the late 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, that kind of mining. And, you know, is it underground mining? Is it, you know, what is that process that is being proposed for the uranium?
Well, what is happening right now is that the Uranium Resources Incorporated, which is headquartered in Texas, they have properties out near Church Rock, New Mexico, which is in the eastern part of the Navajo Reservation. And they have been, they have really put on the pressure through their lobbying efforts with council delegates individually, with the chapters going out and talking to them. I've been watching them at the council chambers, and they are good at that. And what they want is they want to have a demonstration project. And the demonstration project would involve in situ uranium mining. In situ uranium mining is a new method, supposedly, of uranium mining. But it's been around for several years. It's been there in Texas. And it involves using water and very little human the workforce is almost zero. You have someone monitoring what's going on. But the process is the injection of water into the ground, and then it there's a solution that is reportedly not harmful to the water, and it mixes with the uranium ore and then shoots it back out, and that's the uranium mining process. The concern that has been brought up by community members is that there's very little water here on the Navajo Reservation. And that discussion came up with the Peabody Coal Company in the Black Mesa area when they were using thousands of gallons of pristine water from an underground lake, the Navajo Aquifer. And they were using that to mix with pulverized coal and sending it over 300 miles down to Nevada to the Mojave Generating Station, which was using it to generate electricity for California and Las Vegas and Arizona. And then California, the citizens of California decided that they didn't want their power to be coming from coal, that they wanted to go to an alternative energy source because they were becoming very aware of climate change and its effect that that coal has on climate change. And so there was a lot of pressure. Eventually, the water was reduced. The use of water was reduced because the Mojave Generating Station was closed down. It was a very there were several factors in that, and it was because the Mojave Generating Station was very old. And then there was this huge outcry that started because of the social media, and people were getting educated about how that water was being used and that was a pristine aquifer. And then you had also people getting educated about the drought that was occurring. And so that those same issues concerning the use of the water and how people were comparing it to that it was sacrilegious, because for the Navajo listeners and the non-Navajo listeners, in the Navajo way, the teachings are that we were created from four elements of life. And those four elements of life are holy ones, and they are water and fire and air and Mother Earth. And so when you have the elders or even the young people that are very knowledgeable about these teachings, they will talk about how water is sacred, that water is life, and that it would be as if you were abusing your own relative for your own material gain. And so they try to bring this message to the council, and that same message I'm hearing again regarding the uranium, the use of the in situ uranium mining in Church Rock. And so this demonstration project that URI wants to have, they've managed to get it before the Navajo Council's Resources and Development Committee. And in December, which really upset a lot of people, in December, the Resources and Development Committee held a meeting, not here in Window Rock, in the council chambers where they usually meet, but at a small community that was several miles away, and it's called Chilchimbito, and it was in a small chapter house. And that room was barely able to hold about 25 to 30, 40, I think, at the max, were able to go in there. Actually, I don't even think it was 40. Now that I remember it, there was a table there. The resource committee sat at the table, and then there was two rows of chairs, and there must have been about 25 people in there. And the people that had gone out there were very upset that that meeting was there, because you're talking about an area that's called Church Rock. And so Chilchimbito would be probably about how many hours drive. I know from Wind Rock it took me about an hour, almost 2 hours to drive up there, because some of it is a two-lane road and you go through Chinle, Arizona. And so from Wind Rock to the Church Rock area, that's about an hour drive or more. And so you're talking about a three-hour drive for community members from Church Rock up to Chilchimbito, where a decision was made regarding uranium mining in their community. And what happened was that the Resources and Development Committee passed legislation that created this subcommittee to work on a draft agreement with URI for this demonstration project. And so the subcommittee consists of two members. The chairperson is Council Delegate Leonard Sosie and Council Delegate Leonard Peet. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with that type of uranium mining, but I know you know about the history of uranium mining in the Church Rock area, Sharon. So why don't you give us a little bit of background about that?
Well, it all began with actually way back when a Navajo sheep herder actually found a nugget of uranium as he was just herding his sheep, and that was in the mid-1940s. Now, he had a friend who was a geologist, and he knew this rock was different, and it boggles my mind to think that he is actually carrying this nugget of, you know, uranium around with him. He saves it, he gives it to his geologist friend, And, you know, the gentleman takes it to Albuquerque and has it tested, and it's uranium. And that is what started this boom of uranium mining. And it also boggles the mind to think that during that time frame of the late 40s, the 50s, the 60s, all the way to 1980, there were 52 uranium mines in operation all across the Navajo Nation. And Church Rock itself, you know, Marley, that's we I think the reason why this particular proposal and it being in this same area, Church Rock is the site, and many people may not realize this, but it is the site of the largest tailings spill in history on this planet Earth. And remember all the different stories we were having to do, you know, when all those tailings went into the Rio Perco and all those deer livestock that, you know, were drinking that water, and they were having, you know, stillborn calves and lambs, and they were deformed. And that particular spill has never been adequately cleaned up after. It's just been kind of like swept under the rug. So everyone in that area, you know, having to live through that, having to suffer from, you know, the different cancers, you know, that is a particular cancer cluster in this country because of that tailing spill, and also because of the uranium tailings that, you know, continue. I mean, just at the foot of our beautiful sacred mountain, you know, our turquoise mountain outside of Grants, New Mexico, there's a gigantic, you know, tailing spill there. I mean, it's all yellow cake that's there. It still, you know, continues to exist right there at the base of Mount Taylor. And again, like across from, you know, one of the Laguna villages, you know, there's the Laguna village, the railroad tracks, and then at the base of this mesa, again, more tailings and yellow cake that are there from all this past uranium mining.
Well, this issue of the Resources and Development Committee and the URI proposal for a demonstration project, the in-situ uranium mining project, came before the Resources and Development Committee on the 17th. And there was the way it came before the Resources and Development Committee is that one of the Resource Committee members, George Apachito, who comes from the Alamo area, which is near Albuquerque, New Mexico, is sponsoring legislation to rescind the legislation that created the subcommittee. And this subcommittee has existed since December. And each time that Apachito or Council Delegate Apachito has brought that legislation before the Resources and Development Committee, the subcommittee chairman, Leonard Sosi, will argue and ask for more time, that it be delayed, that they are close to negotiating a deal with URI. And there have been council delegates that have come to that meeting, including Council Delegate Danny Simpson, Council Delegate Edmund Yazzie, who are from that area. Council Delegate Edmund Yazzie is actually a council delegate representing the Church Rock area. But each time that they have come and they have questioned this legislation and that's the issue, is that you have the opposition arguing that the subcommittee, that legislation creating the subcommittee to create a draft agreement with URI is a violation of two current laws. One of the laws bans uranium, and the other law bans transportation of hazardous materials, which is uranium. That comes under it. And that the council delegate who sponsored the law for the transportation of hazardous waste is Council Delegate Dwayne Synogeny. And he has raised that issue on the council floor. There are several council delegates that are questioning the Resources and Development Committee's actions, but each time it's brought before the subcommittee and back to the Resources and Development Committee, Council Delegate Leonard Sosi has been able to argue very successfully for additional time. The last time that the legislation came before the Resources and Development Committee, he announced that that URI had actually offered up several thousand acres of their land in exchange for putting that demonstration project out there near Church Rock. And Council Delegate Leonard Pete, who is on that subcommittee, argues that about jobs. And his argument is, you know, you just can't keep saying no to economic development, that unemployment on the reservation is at 45%, that people need these jobs and they have the right to say yes to uranium.
Well, the people that live in this area where they're proposing to do this, what is their standing? Are they in support of it?
There's a council. There's a resolution from the Church Rock chapter that approved the possibility of entering into a draft agreement with URI. And you have to go out to the Church Rock community to look at what they don't have. And this is true, though, across the reservation. And I've always wondered, I've worked here on the reservation for 28 years as a news journalist, as a news reporter. And administration after administration repeatedly gives that excuse. We will exploit the natural resources, which is just not the coal and the uranium or the timber, but it's also the water. And you're also using the air. But they do what they say because of jobs. They want to create jobs. They want to create employment. They want to help the people help themselves. But the unemployment rate continues to be at 45%. And so the elected officials, our elected officials, continue to sacrifice the people through the land, through the contamination of the water, which is what you were talking about, Sharon, that huge tailings spill that happened out at Church Rock. It was the hugest tailing spill ever. And as a news reporter, I'm a member of the Society for Environmental Journalists, and I attend their meetings. And when I attended one of their meetings, and they were talking about how the there was another disaster involving uranium, and they were talking about how that was the most largest uranium disaster in the country. And I said, well, what about Church Rock? Have you heard about Church Rock? They had not heard about Church Rock. And it's because the news media didn't pick it up. And that's what you call environmental racism. There's discrimination among our professionals.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back real soon on Blog Talk Radio. This is Politics on the Navajo Nation with Marlee Shabala.
You're listening to Blog Talk Radio, and this is Politics on the Navajo Nation with Marlee Shabala. And now, back to our program.
Hello, Yat'e, this is Marlee Shabala, Toye Queenie and Shlone as Ejibashishchin, and you're listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation. And once again, our call-in number is 347-989-0048. That number again is 347-989-0048. And before we took our break, I was talking about a meeting that occurred on June 17th, and that was the Navajo Council Resources and Development Committee. And legislation went before them to rescind prior Resources and Development Committee action in December 2013 that created a subcommittee that was charged with drafting an agreement with Uranium Resources Incorporated of Texas for a demonstration project. And the demonstration project would be an in-situ uranium mining near Church Rock, New Mexico, which is on the Navajo Reservation. And the sponsor of that legislation, Council Delegate George Apachito, when that legislation came before the committee, he asked that it be removed from the agenda, which allowed more time for that subcommittee to continue talking with URI about this proposed demonstration project. But at the end of the meeting, after the committee had voted 4-0 to delete Council Delegate George Apachito's legislation from their agenda, the Resources and Development Committee Chairperson, Catherine Benally, informed Council Delegate Leonard Sosi, who's a Resources and Development Committee member and also the chair of the subcommittee, that she was going to put Council Delegate George Apachito's legislation, which is number 0104-14, back on the committee's agenda for their August 27th meeting. So that legislation is still alive, and it's going to be on the committee's agenda for their August 27th meeting. But Chairperson Benally also told Council Delegate Leonard Sosi that if Council Delegate George Apachito wanted his legislation to be put on the committee's agenda before August 27th, that was his prerogative as a council delegate, and she would respect that. She also reminded Council Delegate Leonard Sosi that the last time that the committee had delayed action on Council Delegate George Apachito's legislation, that the committee had given the subcommittee a deadline of 3 to 6 months. And so August 27th was the end of the 6 months. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with this legislation.
You know, Marlee, I was just thinking that, you know, this is the first time since the 70s that, you know, we've really have a situation with this election and the candidates standing, not only the ones running for president, but also for council. The Navajo people want to know what their plans are or what their stand is for uranium, for coal, on the drought, on the water, on the horses. I mean, it's amazing how it all seems, this election seems to be centering on all the issues about Mother Earth.
It's interesting. I totally agree with you, Sharon, because when I was looking at the comments that were being made regarding the posts about the Asai Lake fire, one of the individuals commented that she wasn't surprised because in the Navajo way, horses are the ones that are the connection between the rain and Mother Earth, Father Sky and Mother Earth, and that there are songs for the horses. And I was talking with Brad Millicote, and she continues to be a very well-known singer in the Navajo and English language. And she's also a former Miss Navajo. And I was talking to her about the comment because she's going to be doing a fundraising for the individuals, the evacuees of the Asai Lake fire. and that's going to be tomorrow up in Shiprock, and people should attend that. But she knows several of the horse songs, and she understood what I was talking about, and she said that it's not only the horses that are being abused, that we as Navajo people are allowing to be abused, that we're part of this because we elect these elected, you know, these public servants into office, and they're the ones that are representing us. They're doing all of this in our name, in the name of the Navajo people. Let's, you know, have these horse roundups, you know. And I can understand, you know, the issues concerning the condition of the land, which is drought. But there are other factors involved, and we've talked about this, Sharon, that you have a huge number of cattle that are out there. That it's always the finger is always pointed at these horses, these feral horses, or even at the sheep. But it has to also be, there has to be recognition that there's a drought, that there's climate change, and that is connected with coal, with fossil fuel. The Navajo Council and President Shelley's full support, they bought a coal mine, and there's a drought. They were allowing water to be taken off the reservation, millions of gallons of water. The first time that humans touched the Navajo aquifer was a coal mine. We allowed that to happen. We allow Navajo Generating Station. That lease was renewed, and that dealt with water and Central Arizona Project. And then the people became educated about the proposed Navajo, the Little Colorado Water Settlement. And people came out, and they were so outraged when they finally realized what was in the fine print, that it was approving a coal agreement with Peabody Coal Company for Navajo Generating Station, that there was also water involved for Navajo Generating Station, that Navajo Generating Station is the one that powers the water that is put into those canals that go down to the metropolitan areas down in Phoenix. So if you're in Phoenix and you're sitting there and you're having these puffs of sprays of water on you as you eat, that's coming from Navajo Generating Station.
Now let's not also forget fracking, you know, as you know, or as our illustrious president says, fractions. But honestly, not only the coal and the drought situation, but you know, we cannot forget the fracking. There's just too much water being used for these different industries, and we're not getting a lot back. And considering we live on the high desert, and you know, we're in a drought. Again, Navajo people want to know, what is this candidate, the next person who is going to sit in that presidential seat, what are they going to do? And it's just like I've never seen it before, people wanting to know their stand on these environmental issues. And you kind of wish that this could have been 20 years ago.
The issues regarding what's happening with the coal, the fossil fuel, which is connected to climate change. And with climate change, you have these extreme weather conditions, and that's what a key factor in what's happening with the drought. Right now on the East Coast, they're getting an unusual amount of, it's their hurricane season, but they're also getting water. And people who live here on the Navajo Reservation notice the weather change. We've had, how much snow did we have? Very, very little. I remember living out at Church Rock. I lived in Church Rock. And when I was in the fifth grade, there was so much snow that it was up to my waist. Every year, there used to be a flood through Church Rock. We would just jump in that water and float with it. And all of that has changed. If you read some of the historical records of the priests, the Catholic priests, they describe the land as lush, that you could grow anything anywhere, that we had farms everywhere. I mean, and this wasn't what you would call the Western way of farming, which is a field of corn, a field of pumpkins, a field of melons. It was all together. We had melons growing next to the corn and chili next to the pumpkins and peach trees, and we sustained ourselves. And right now, you look at how much fresh produce costs, and it's going up. They are announcing that, you know, these fresh fruits and vegetables are increasing in price because of the climate change. The weather has changed the growth season for the vegetables and the fresh fruits, and it's also affecting the cattle. But here on the reservation, we're looked at as organic farmers from the outside, and our tribal leaders, our elected officials, our public servants, what are they doing to help support the small farmers, these businesses, where they have to go to the flea markets?
Remember the terminology that Noel used last week, you know, a food desert. And in my family, one of the favorite stories that we have is our great-grandfather would walk between Window Rock and Fort Defiance and near the formation that they call the King and Queen. And it's a very high 2 points of, you know, sandstone points on these high cliffs that are over 1,000 feet high. But, you know, he would walk below, and he had to struggle to walk because the native grass was so high. And, you know, that just, you know, in support of what you're saying, how lush everything used to be. And then you consider all the different Navajo names of the different places that are translated into English now, like Bird Springs, Tulani Lake, just to name two of the many, many, you know, they have water in their names. And now there's nothing out there. There is no water, all because of what was going on, you know. Let's not forget diverting, you know, the Colorado River and cutting off those aquifers and those dams that were built. And then also all that, you know, the Navajo or the lake underneath. I mean, that is so profound that you said that the first time, you know, human beings touched that water from that aquifer, it was a coal mine. I mean, let that sink in. That's just phenomenal. And then, you know, other places that used to have water and no longer have water.
When I was out at Church Rock, the Resources and Development Committee had a meeting out there, the subcommittee did, under great pressure from Council Delegate Edmund Yazzie, and he was the one that arranged that meeting out there. And that place was packed. You had people of all ages, and they were coming up there, and one story after the other. And veterans, they had so many veterans there that remembered that huge spill out there and what it had done to affect their families. One of the veterans brought tears to my eyes. He was talking about how he had come back from the Vietnam War, how he had gone to the Vietnam War. His brothers went to the Vietnam War. They went out there because in their hearts, this is their homeland, and they went to protect the homeland. That's what they thought, and they believed. And they came home, and they saw how their homeland had been contaminated, how it had been destroyed. But not only that, they started watching their mother, their father, their brothers, all dying from cancer because of that tailing spill. I talked with a friend of mine, a childhood friend of mine, and he had worked for the uranium mine. And he testified in front of that subcommittee how the United Nuclear Industry had the Navajo workers, he was witness to this, had them bury that hazardous waste out there instead of having it transported elsewhere. How they knew that that dam was leaking. And that it was, you know, it was the percentage of it breaking was pretty high. And these are these uranium companies. And out there, they are still dealing with that. And they were talking about the subcommittee chairperson, Leonard Sosi, when he heard the families talking about how contaminated the area was, he wanted to start a program to relocate them. He says, well, you know, why don't you relocate? You know, we can put you somewhere, you know, where there won't be contaminated areas. And the response from the Church Rock community, from these community people, from the families, men and women, was what I had heard from the Navajo families that were relocated to make way for Peabody Coal Company up around Big Mountain and Black Mesa and those areas. They said, we have lived here all our lives. In the Navajo way, they talked about their umbilical cords being buried there and how in the Navajo way that's very strong to keep you there at home so that you will stay with your family, to keep families together. And they talked about, you know, what the land looked like before the tailings happened. And the tailings is not only contaminate and yes, it killed the people, but it also killed the trees. This veteran talked about how there were trees around their home, and he says they're gone. They're not there anymore. And Delegate Leonard Sosie told him, well, I want you to bring those pictures to me of what your home looked like. I want to see it. And he said, I can't. I didn't take pictures. These are my memories, my childhood memories. I'll draw you pictures, and I'll bring it to you.
That's incredible. Bring me pictures. I just had a flashback, Marley, of you and I remember Patty Martinez, the Navajo gentleman that found the first nugget of uranium. He did that at the base of Haystack Mountain, which is just outside of Grants, New Mexico, and thus it began after that, the uranium mining. But I had a flashback of you and I. Do you remember us wearing these really thick rubber boots, and we went to Haystack Mountain, and we were touring some of those uranium sites because, once again, you know, there had been 8 people that were reported having brain tumors. And we went out there because it was a cancer cluster. And I just remember you and I in those big old duck boots, you know, wading through those areas that, you know, we had a Geiger counter with us. Remember that? And that Geiger counter was, you know, clicking away. And you know, when I look back on that now, you know, in my older years, I think, were we crazy or what? But then, you know, we had the protection of those thick duck boots, but, you know, our Navajo people don't have that protection. They're still out there, and how many of those sites have never been, you know, correctly or properly cleaned up and covered over. And remember the one Navajo lady, the timbers that she was using in her hogan out there, the Geiger counter was clicking away. Remember that?
That was one of the... That was one of the issues that was brought by community members. And the community members identified themselves as being from Red Pond. They were the Red Pond community members. And they had organized themselves to talk about the impact of the former uranium mining in their area, especially the tailings spill. And they had firsthand knowledge, and they continue to have that firsthand knowledge. And as I listened to them, I just could not believe that Council Delegate Leonard Sosie and Council Delegate Leonard Peet on their own did not say, we need to pull back. We need to stop and reconsider what the subcommittee is doing in drafting this agreement with this uranium company. We need to have this area cleaned up. And Leonard Sosie started pointing a finger and saying, well, it was the federal government. They should be doing this cleanup. Why isn't anyone holding the federal government accountable? And one of the longtime, this gentleman has been out there forever, Chris Shuey. He's with the Southwest Information Center. And he has been huge in educating the people about the impact of uranium and helping them to organize so that they can have those guide counters, so they can monitor the air, so they can monitor the water, so they can be able to speak up for themselves. And that's what they're doing. They have started their own local governance, and that's what I saw. But for the subcommittee, it was still a matter of, well, somebody needs to hold the federal government accountable. Why aren't you out there protesting? I don't see you protesting. Well, who's doing anything out here? We're trying to do something here because you need money to do the cleanup. And so this URI is offering money. And the way they're offering the money is, and I've sat in these meetings, and their rationale is, I'll go back a little bit. They made an agreement with the Navajo Department of Justice, URI did, to do a cleanup at their former uranium site. And then they could start talking about possibly doing some uranium mining on their properties. But instead, they went the back door and started pressuring the individual council delegates, and this is where they're at now with the subcommittee. But they're also saying that the standard for the cleanup is too high. It's too high because it's too costly. And because it's too costly, then they can't do the cleanup. But if the standard was reduced, it would be less costly, and so the cleanup could move along faster. So that's the rationale. Let's reduce the standard for the cleanup of the uranium contamination. And if we reduce that standard, then we can afford to do the cleanup of a larger area. And I don't know why this subcommittee keeps saying that those standards were made by the outside and that there are no health statistics to support those standards. But then Navajo Environmental Protection Agency came forward and said, no, you know, we have standards. We're using those standards. And, yes, we want a health study. And then they come back and say, well, we don't have any money for the health study. So then the uranium company says, well, you know, we can help with the money if you reduce the standards.
A lot of what you and I are talking about, you know, the things that we've seen, the stories we've heard, you know, just I know that a lot of people are not going to like us talking about this, particularly those who are in support of going ahead with this uranium issue. But these are stories that don't get out there. It's just like you were saying, you know, with, you know, environmental reporting. They don't talk about this. These people, you know, these dear Navajo people who have had to suffer all of this, who have lost family members, you know, to these different cancers, you know, they feel like they don't have a voice. And, you know, why isn't, you know, the national media here, you know, covering this issue because of what happened in Church Rock? They didn't even cover that spill when it happened.
The justification is something that I've heard as a news reporter from my fellow colleagues is that, well, there's nobody out there, so it didn't have a huge impact. To them, if they don't see a town, a huge city, then, oh, you know, then the impact is not as great. And yet to us, one life is worth 100. You can't put a price tag on one life, and that's what the message was that was being brought by the community members to this subcommittee. It's the same message that was brought by the Navajo people when they were talking about the coal mining by Peabody. It's the same message that's being heard at Navajo Generating Station for the lease renewal. The people came and they talked about the water, the land, the air. It's the same argument that Navajo people brought to the council again just before they were purchasing Navajo Mine, when they were going to renew the lease for Four Corners Power Plant. All of these issues is the same message, and it's being brought by different Navajo people, and it's being brought for years and years. I've heard it for the past 28 years as a news reporter on the Navajo Reservation.
Now, I know Bill Donovan feels that Mr. Shelley has his base and Mr. Shirley has his base, but, you know, I think, you know, we can go out on a limb here and say that, you know, these environmental issues, the coal mine, the uranium, the drought, the horses, the water, all of this is going to make or break these different people, you know, their elections, you know, whether they're running for council delegate or whether they're running for Navajo president.
It's an issue that the Navajo voters need to express to the candidates. We as Navajo people need to question our council delegates. We need to question the candidates for council. We need to question our president, our vice president. We need to question all of the political appointees, which are the division directors for natural resources, for Navajo Environmental Protection Agency, our tribal justice department, the candidates for president. They all need to be held accountable because we're not moving. Where are we going to move? This is our homeland. We're contaminating our homeland. We're contaminating ourselves. We're contaminating all of life here, the fire, air, and water. And it's all connected. There is no separation. You can't have, it's not like having a drawer where you have all our cabinet with all these different spaces and, you know, they're all separated. It's all connected, and those are our teachings. And I'd like to once again thank all of our listeners for tuning in to Politics on the Navajo Nation. And tune in next week from 7 to 9 p.m. And we'd love to hear from you. So Facebook us. Let us know you're out there listening. Let us know if you agree with us. Let us know if you disagree with us. Let us know what's happening in your area.
Thank you for listening to Blog Talk Radio and Politics on the Navajo Nation, sponsored by CalNez Design. And thank you all for joining us. Blog Talk Radio.